Welcome to It's About Florida, a weekly discussion program tackling the key issues and topics of interest to our state. I'm Tramell Gomes. Ken Tucker was appointed by Governor Rick Scott as Secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections back in August, following the resignation of Edwin Buss. Governor Scott said differences in philosophy and management styles arose which made Buss's separation in the best interest of the state. Tucker is a 34-year law enforcement veteran who left his post as Assistant Commissioner of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement to take over one of the country's largest prison systems. Tucker sits down with our Chief Legislative News Producer, James Call, and talks about his philosophy and management style. This interview was conducted just a day before the department announced the closures of 7 prisons and 4 work camps, which includes River Junction Work Camp in Chattahoochee and the Jefferson Correctional Institution.
Ken Tucker, you are the secretary of the third largest prison system in the United States.
Yes, I am. It's certainly my pleasure to be here with you today and talk about that role at the Department of Corrections.
You have more than 34 years as a lawman, and you started your career walking a beat as a Daytona Beach police officer.
Yes, going all the way back to the mid-70s. After serving in the United States Army, I started out as a patrol officer with the Daytona Beach Police Department. I worked there almost 7 years and spent the bulk of that, probably a little over 5 years of it, as part of a drug task force doing a lot of undercover drug investigations.
But the arc you designed for your career did not include corrections, let alone becoming the top guy of a mega prison system. You supervised more than 28,000 people on your payroll. Tell us about the moment when your supervisor at FDLE told you the governor's office was going to call and ask you to lead the Florida Department of Corrections.
Well, that was definitely one of those days in my life I would always highlight as being very interesting. I was serving as the assistant commissioner of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. I was over operations, criminal investigations, and crime lab services statewide. That was my area of responsibility. And I received a call from Commissioner Bailey, who said he had just left the governor's office and was headed back to the FDLE office and wanted to see me. So when he got there, he brought me in and told me that the governor wanted to meet with me. And I inquired as to what the purpose of the meeting was. And he basically indicated they wanted to discuss with me about being the secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections. As you can imagine, my initial response to that was somewhat shocked. Yeah, my entire background has been being part of investigations of actually investigating people and putting them into prison. So I had never really contemplated serving within the Department of Corrections, much less serving as the head of a very, very large correctional system in this country.
Do you find it interesting that your background and career had been in investigations, undercover work and investigating, and the governor picked you to lead the Department of Corrections? Is there anything to read into that?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, I know that the governor, and looking for who would be serving as the next secretary, had made a calls to a lot of people. And a number of them provided my name to him as someone that would go into the Department of Corrections, that would be able to conduct business in a manner that was consistent with all the rules, policies, and policy decisions from the governor and the legislature as it related to how they wanted to see that agency ran.
After becoming secretary, you witnessed the execution of a death row inmate. Published comments attributed to you indicate the experience caused you to reexamine some of your beliefs. Is that a fair assessment?
It is, and I have always been and remain a proponent of the death penalty. However, when you're put into a position of being involved in the implementation of a death penalty, of an execution, it does cause you to reevaluate, to look over the basis for your beliefs. It was just one of those events in your life that makes you kind of go back and start comparing and contrasting your religious beliefs versus your professional responsibilities and your experiences in life. And again, I'll reaffirm that I'm still a proponent I've been very impressed with those that are part of the Department of Corrections that are responsible for implementing those executions. They do it with the highest degree of dignity, humanity, as much as possible that you're, caring for someone in the final hours of their life and they know they're going to be executed.
You mentioned your religious beliefs. How did you reconcile your professional responsibilities with your religious beliefs?
It did not take me so far that I thought the implementation of the death penalty was a violation of my religious beliefs. It just made me go back to that side of my life and basically look at the two. And ultimately, as it relates to the implementation of an execution, the governor issues a warrant for the execution. And ultimately, I have a professional responsibility. The first execution that Governor Scott signed, a warrant, was my first execution as well. So both of us had that discussion about, regardless of those beliefs, we have a professional responsibility. The law is clear on how those are to be done, how they're to be carried out. And basically, I think as human beings, we both acknowledge that it was one of those things that makes you think.
On becoming secretary, you stated you saw the offer to become secretary as a great opportunity to reduce recidivism. About a third of inmates return to prison within 3 years. Is that acceptable? A third returning?
No, I think obviously our goal should be to get it down as low as possible. I don't think 30%. In comparison to some other states, it's a good number, but it's still one that's unacceptable. I've been at the Department of Corrections a little over 4 months, and as I look at the long-term ability to reduce recidivism, to reduce the cost of prisons, to reduce many of the issues associated with programs in prisons and everything, is to focus on reducing victimization and recidivism. You will always hear me acknowledge the victim. Coming from 35 years in a law enforcement background, I've seen the consequences of crime. I've seen the impacts on families, on friends, on the victims. So I'll always have that in my thoughts as I look at it. However, if we don't take steps to correct those problems, those issues that cause that criminal act to occur, then it's going to repeat itself. And then there's just more victims. There's more cost to the state. So as I've developed an agenda for where I'd like to try to move the Department of Corrections, it definitely involves developing a strategy. A strategy that talks about reentry of reducing recidivism. And not having that strategy kick in when someone's in their final 60 days within the system, that it begins on the day they arrive within a Department of Corrections institution. We start developing those programs, those things. If you look at the education level of the population of the Florida Department of Corrections, it's somewhere around 6th, 7th grade level average. So high school GEDs, that's important. You raise their educational level. A lot of people are in there with drug abuse problems. We have to focus on our abilities to do our best to try to treat those that have a drug abuse problem. I know that there are some policy decisions that will probably be discussed in the legislature this year as it relates to drug offenders and how to deal with them. But overall, I think it is the right thing to do to look at reducing recidivism, because ultimately the long-term solution to a continued reduction in crime, to reduce the cost of incarceration, and to really move forward as a society, that absolutely should be our goal.
I appreciate that you've been secretary for 4 months and you're still trying to get your arms around a massive department, 100,000 inmates, 28,000 employees. But do you have the resources to provide the training needed for inmates to get a GED, the resources to rehabilitate drug addicts. We've undergone 6 years of budget shortfalls, 6 years of spending cuts. The prison system has been affected. Do you have the resources to reduce recidivism?
That's a great question. I don't know that I can tell you at this point in time. I think as we move forward in our efforts to reduce recidivism and develop the strategy of reducing recidivism, it is my intention to expand the partnerships that we have, to go into communities. You know, a large percentage of those currently within our prisons will get out of prison at some point. We release, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood 20 to 30,000 inmates a year back out into the communities. The strategy would involve engaging those communities that, look, when this person reaches the end of their prison sentence, they've indicated they want to come back and live in your community. Now, we would like you to partner with us. We would like you to assist us. And if we aren't able to deliver all those programs while they're within the walls of the institutions, as we look at work release, as we look at some of these community-based programs, let's try to move them and engage the communities to partner with us in delivering those. You know, if we want to ensure the success or at least increase the probabilities of success for someone getting out of prison, there's a couple of fundamental things. One of them is the education. Two is a job. And three is some form of identification. Many people getting out of prison, their driver's license has expired. They have no form of identification. So something as simple as being able to have a Florida ID card or, if they're eligible, a Florida driver's license is important, because you can't even buy an airplane ticket. You can't even, many hotels won't register you without some form of identification. So just some of those basics. And then from there, you move into the other areas that changes behavior, that changes their ability to adapt to, you know, many of the expectations of a law-abiding society.
And in many cases, you don't have a receptive audience in the inmate.
And absolutely. There are those that they have, drug abuse problems, and trying to compel someone to complete a drug abuse program is not effective. That's proven, that, you know, just forcing someone to do that. Many of those that go through our system will decline being put into a drug treatment program. However, I think as we look at the population, there's, you know, and again, based on 4 months of experience, so I have to qualify everything I say, but there's a lot of experts that work there. There's a lot of professionals that have been part of the system for a long time, and I'm talking to them, and I'm talking to people outside of the Department of Corrections. Many times when you hear me talk, I'll talk about the concept of corrections in Florida versus putting the whole responsibility on the Department of Corrections. But if we look at that population, there's primarily three groups. There are those first offenders that are serving relatively short prison sentences that more than likely will go through their incarceration, get out, and probably never commit another crime. So we need to make sure what we're doing with them is keeping them on that track, not doing anything that would change that track. But I don't know that we need to invest heavily in that group. The other side of it is you've got those that are never going to get out of prison. They are there for the rest of their life. And those we've got, we've got to do those things that we're constitutionally mandated to do, provide them food, provide them health care, all of that, and then provide them those things that keep them from being idle. But I don't know that we need to invest in a lot of other programs that are geared toward reintegrating them back into society. The target group, the target audience, is that group of inmates in the middle. They're at higher risk. The things that put them behind bars, if it's not altered, will probably repeat itself when they get out. So that's looking at taking those limited resources that you described earlier and focusing them on the right group, the right population. And I don't want to see anyone get shortchanged. We want to afford everyone the opportunity to succeed. Within the limits of my statutory authority and within the limits of my resources.
You mentioned the concept of corrections. I'm getting the idea from your comments that your concept is it's an opportunity to help redeem someone, not necessarily an opportunity to punish?
A prison sentence by its nature is a punishment. I'm a firm believer, though, that that does not mean that we as a correctional system need to try to do anything except, you know, number one, our first and primary role is public safety. We have people in prison. They don't want to be in prison. Many of them are threats if they're outside of prison without some modification in their behavior. However, that doesn't preclude us from doing everything we can to treat them with the dignity and respect that any human being deserves. It doesn't preclude us from seeking opportunities to better equip them to reside within a community as a productive member of that community. And as I look at the Department of Corrections and I reflect back on my previous career, you know, I've been involved in putting people in prison. And to be honest, some of them, I kind of hoped they would never get out and come back because I knew it was going to probably mean another investigation of them. But in my new role, I do have to look at things a little differently. No matter where you're at in the spectrum of what prison ought to be, whether it's punishment, whether it's trying to do everything you can to increase them, the end result, if we do nothing, is high recidivism, continued victimization, continued crimes being committed. So I don't think anyone can argue the goal of trying to correct those things and reduce that probability is not the smart thing to do.
This is It's About Florida. I'm Tramell Gomes. You're listening to an interview with Florida Department of Corrections Secretary Ken Tucker, conducted by Chief Legislative News Producer James Call.
You supervise 62 prisons, 45 work camps, and 5 road prisons. Have you had a chance to go out and do a survey to visit some of the prisons and some of the facilities under your realm?
I have, and I wish I had the luxury of spending every day till I visited every one of them. Mm-hmm. When I came into office, committee weeks had already started in the legislature. So every other week I'm trying to hit some. And now we're in session, which will further restrict my ability to get out there. Mm-hmm. But I have visited.
What's the state of the facilities?
You have to understand that description you just provided is a lot of different levels of facilities. When you go to a facility like Florida State Prison or Union Correctional, they're housing some of the most violent, most problematic inmates we have. So that's going to be a lot tighter security. That's going to be a lot more controls on inmate movement. And then you go all the way to the spectrum of a work camp. Those are inmates that have proven through their time in the system that they've earned some degree of trust, and you can put them out there where they're actually with supervision going out into the community and performing work. We have a lot of contracts with the Department of Transportation where inmate labor is used. We have a lot of different programs. So overall, I think the one observation that I have that's concerning at times is the lack of activities that we have the resources to deliver to preclude that idleness, that idle time. Anyone given the opportunity to sit 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and do nothing but think about things probably isn't a good solution. So one of the goals I have is looking for those activities, those things. As I look at where I want to try to go, one of the components of that is our inmate classification system. A lot of questions have been asked. There was a recent study that brought into question, are we properly classifying inmates? Because that's what determines where they go, what programs they can get into. And so one of the goals I have is to get a real good evaluation of our classification system so that if the opportunity exists for community-based programs, work release-type programs, that we make sure we've identified those people that present minimal risk to our communities to put into those. It is a balancing act for the Department of Corrections. You know, I think in many cases we're almost expected to predict human behavior, and that's not possible. 34 years in law enforcement, I know that. But we can use assessment tools. We can look around the country, and I think we're well down the road, but making sure we've got a system in place that's identifying those people that present minimal risk, that if an opportunity comes to put them into a community-based drug treatment program, we can send them. If the opportunity comes to put them into some type of work release program, we can send them. And, but unfortunately, I think the history of the department is this is one of those areas where a 99% success rate is almost wiped away by a failure, someone that's put out in the community and commits a serious crime. But again, you know, we just got to make sure we're doing everything we can to make sure we're putting at least those that are calculated to be the lowest risk or threat level and reintegrating them. Because the other option is just to keep them behind the bars until that day when their sentence is up and we walk them outside the gate and tell them they're free to go.
You administer a budget of about $2 billion. The governor is recommending a cut of $100 million. How do you find the savings? How do you find $100 million in savings?
Well, in this particular year, the two big areas that those savings will be realized, the good news side of this is, we are sitting on a number of empty prison beds within our prisons. On top of that, I think going back several years ago, the projections were that by the next year or two, our population would be over 112,000 inmates. Well, we're just a little over 100,000. So when you look at our capacity and the number of inmates, we can gain a lot of that by a consolidation effort. As I look across a lot of our institutions, we have dorms that are completely empty. You know, it doesn't make sense to keep a half-full dorm because the staffing requirements from a correctional officer perspective are the same, whether it's half-full or completely full. So by closing that dorm down, we now have freed up staff that we can use elsewhere or we can hold as a vacancy to address some of these budget cuts that we're facing. So as we look at that consolidation issue, in the neighborhood of 4,500 to 5,000 beds that of capacity that will be eliminated, we can realize a substantial part of that $100 million right there. Another area that we're looking at, and it's one that for the most part is favored by those correctional officers that work within the Department of Corrections, is moving away from 8-hour shifts to 12-hour shifts.
Corrections officers are in favor of that move?
I can't speak for every correctional officer in the state, and I wouldn't presume to. However, I do know that as I visit the institutions, one of the most frequent questions I'm asked is, when is their institution going to be allowed to move to the 12-hour shift? So there are a lot of those out there that look forward to that.
And so how does that work? You work 4 days, 12 hours, get 3 days off?
Or? It kind of flip-flops back and forth. And I think what makes it appealing is under the current system of seniority and everything else, many of those that are newer in the system, it will be quite some time before they see the ability to have weekends off and those. But with the 12-hour shifts, it almost works out where everyone gets every other weekend off. So it presents a lot more flexibility to those correctional officers that work within the Department of Corrections. And right now we actually already have one pilot in place. Moving forward, it's proven to be very effective. It's well received by those that are in it. And we're moving to implement a second pilot project at Suwannee Correctional Institute and within the next several weeks. And then as we move further, but again, that's another area where there are substantial savings that can be realized. Ultimately, it will result in a loss of positions. At this point, we're holding vacancies, and it's our plan as we implement both of these to – absolutely work with the members of the Department of Corrections that will be impacted and minimize that impact on them.
You've already set a retirement date. That makes you a short timer, which doesn't that decrease your effectiveness to implement changes by having your retirement date already announced? I mean, people know that you're only here until the end of 2013.
That was a discussion that I had. I made the day the governor asked me about this. I raised that as an issue. And ultimately, the Department of Corrections has had five secretaries in the last 6 years. And I absolutely asked the governor to at least give consideration to allowing me to build a team. And as part of that team, have a couple of people that would be mentored and groomed to replace me, and that he consider appointing one of them when I leave. I think as I build the agenda, and I'm pretty satisfied now that I have that team in place and those people that are capable of being mentored for that appointment. And so ultimately it will be seamless. Now, that said, my retirement date has determined because I had been at the end of my career at the Department of Law Enforcement. I entered the drop program. And in March of 2013, I reached the end of that drop period. I will acknowledge that at this point, the opportunity that's presented to me here, of course, right now the law is clear. When March 2013 comes, it's time for me to look for other opportunities. I have regrets about that. I actually see many, many opportunities here. I see an opportunity to do a lot of positive things, and probably most importantly, combined with the many members of the Department of Corrections, I see an opportunity to make some very, very great changes to move a system that can prove to be more effective than previous. I acknowledged earlier we got 30% recidivism, and it's one of the lowest in the country. But so at this point, and you can look at this two ways. If you go March 2013, it means you can say you only have 14 months left before you finish your career. I actually look at that differently. I have 14 months left. I can do a lot of things in 14 months. And with the team that we've put together and we are having, establishing excellent partnerships with those outside of the Department of Corrections, the private providers, a lot of the volunteer groups, the faith-based organizations, with the relationship that we have with our governor's office and with many of those in the legislature, I think we have a tremendous opportunity. And I have 14 months left to do a lot of things that hopefully will carry on and make a difference within that 14 months and then go well beyond my departure.
Ken Tucker, thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Special thanks to our guests, Florida Department of Corrections Secretary Ken Tucker and Chief Legislative News Producer James Call. You've been listening to It's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. Our senior producer is Regan McCarthy with technical assistance provided by Taylor Cox. Please join us again next week for more discussions about the issues impacting our state. I'm Tramell Gomes.